Okay, friends, we will attempt to continue, if we do, in this series, VAA 81E, perhaps, unless we make it EAA 82, depends on how much I have time for today. And we continue our exploration of these matters, really pondering them. I think that's what the second ray does. It ponders what is said and offers us the chance to expand the ideas and bring in possibly more light through more connections. Every link produces a flash of light, if it's a real link, and that's what we're trying to do. So, until Section E, or until we go going on 82, we will see. Okay, we've been speaking about money as concretized energy. We've been speaking of the necessity of law, affinity, and concretized energy to create money. This is mysterious in some respects. Usually it seems simply like a decision to produce a medium of exchange. But to accumulate money, I think these three are certainly needed. And there must be energy at the disposal of the one who uses money. In other words, the latent reservoir of energy must exist, otherwise the creative power of money would not exist. We're on Esoteric Astrology Adventure 81, Section E, page 246 in the Libra chapter. So we're talking about the creation of money. We're talking about the third aspect of divinity over which Libra especially presides. And he talks about the mystery of money. It's not a straightforward thing at all. The creative process, as I said, is one of arranging and rearranging of movement, of activity, in order to create new combinations, and especially combinations which reflect intended combinations, plan and purpose intended combinations, which are reflective of archetypes. The materialization of the pattern in heaven is what is required. And what we call money, however it is, in whatever forms it may present itself, has to do with this materialization of the divine intention. It is a symbolic incentive for the creative act. Of course, sometimes creativity, and really oftentimes, is pursued for its own sake, to answer an inner demand and a love of beauty, but in this world, which is also somewhat ruled by Caesar, and not yet fully by Christ, one has to meet the material needs. And money seems to be the way, however it is conceived, of meeting material needs. We could say that energy will do it, and that we can enter into a barter system, and that the energy at the disposal of each human being can be directed as he wills, provided there is a return energy flow which allows him to sustain himself. Anyway, a mystery is connected here. And it is here, says the Tibetan, that many mystics and even world servers prove futile. World servers? Even world servers prove futile. The mystic futility we can understand because there is a disengagement from the world. But world servers, well, you would think they would be more practical. It depends on how we use the word. They work from far too high a level. And from the standpoint of spiritual incentive, maybe he's saying only spiritual incentive. We have to be practical in our work so that we can concretize something in the third aspect of divinity. I mean, it's part of the soul infusion process on our planet. It's not just living in the soul, it's bringing the soul into matter. The seventh ray should help, and Aquarius should help. It will teach us how to be practical mystics and practical servers. They normally and naturally, because that is where their focus of consciousness is placed, work from the standpoint of the second aspect. But we have to bring these aspects together, don't we? Whereas it is the third aspect, equally divine and equally important. This is such an important emphasis, which must be invoked and evoked. Ponder on these words. We must call for. We must ask. And there will be an evocation or a response, but we have to even ask in the world of material energy, world of money. There was a man, D.K., he played a fairly important role in the Arcane School. I think he was Alice Bailey's secretary. His rays were 2-4, 4-2, 3? I can't remember exactly. Or was it 7? Anyway, it was 2-4, 4-2, and then a 3 or a 7. And D.K. complimented him on his willingness to ask for money as needed, even though he had the typical second ray horror of doing so, of actually asking for the material needs. He overcame his reticence and acted courageously in this respect. Something thought form has been attached to money that it is somehow not spiritual. A dirty something, something that only has to do with lower types of individuals, and of course that's a huge cleavage, and does render mystics and world servers futile. So we actually have to ask, we have to be on the side of the law, that is, working with the plan. We have to express affinity with others and be magnetic and return to them something of radiatory value. So they are attracted not only by us, but what we do, which is serving the law, the plan. And then, of course, we have to exert the energy, which renders us magnetic in line with the lawful expression of the plan. And then that is our invocation. We ask, we call, we invoke by lawfully attracting through the use of our energy those who can support these intentions which are plan-based. The evocation will come. He asks us to ponder on these words. It is not the bringing together of spirit and matter as occultism understands these terms, because after all, that is a very high thing, the bringing together of spirit and matter. That's at the basis of all that has been created. Rather, it's something else. It's the relating of physical need and physical supply. This is something the seventh ray is excellent at doing. It controls the things by which man lives, the relating of physical need and physical supply, and the bringing together of two tangibles through the power of the creative imagination. That's part of our invocation too, isn't it? In the Tibetans' meditation for money for spiritual purposes, the creative imagination plays a big part. We imagine the flowing golden substance flowing out of the material sources and into the hands of the forces of light. We bring together two tangibles, that is, the need and the money, through the power of the creative imagination. So often, you know, money is simply a symbol, and the giving of money is a symbolic transference. It's a These days, it's one internet procedure away. It's the changing of certain numbers. It's the movement of certain numbers. We'll be appreciated as having the symbolic value of energy, and will empower and energize the object of the transference. So we're not thinking of spirit and matter, we're thinking of that which must be done, and this tangible, intangible something called money. It is for this reason that so many schools of thought prove so successful in materializing that which is required. They're not so much given to pursuit of the second ray, are they? While other schools of thought, and why other schools of thought so signally fail, they work from too high a plane and have not the ability to carry through. Seventh ray particularly gives this ability to carry through. So when you have seventh ray people associated with your organization, there is that kind of follow through and a determination to make things real, make things actual, make them appear, make them manifest. So we have to seek changes upon the dense physical plane, changes of a tangible nature, whether it's building a building, writing a book, things that have to be done. And we have to invoke the supply that will allow these things to be done. It's invocation of a symbolic supply, okay. But it is a supply nonetheless. And the Tibetan is not being too concrete about this. He says, I've here given you hints which can be fruitful of result if interpreted correctly and acted upon from right motive. We have to set our thought form on the proper path, right? But the magician set his form upon the proper path. From right motive and in-group formation, not just as an individual, but to feed and supply that which will be of group good. Group invocation is probably even more impressive and useful than individual invocation. And with selfless purpose, these are the ways we have to act to attract money for hierarchical purposes. I think we have to be very persuasive, in a way, about why the ageless wisdom is so necessary in the world, and that is sometimes a hard case to make. We're talking about changes in human consciousness, which will lead to changes in the outer world, but people don't necessarily see the connection. They want to go with the changes in the outer world without realizing that none of those changes will be true to plan unless they are backed by the proper kinds of consciousness. We, on the second ray, our second aspect groups tend to work with consciousness. We need also to work with the will, the one and the three, reflected in the seven. This is a financial combination. Have we been futile? What have we produced? What the Tibetan hope for? I think not. Though probably some progress has been made, and usually he's more generous in his assessment than we are, because he sees all the different ways that good has been done, ways which are not obvious or visible to us. But anyway, working within the third aspect, right motive, the power of the group, selflessness, and the energy of love, of course, this is one of the key ingredients. Maybe we can call it affinity, as he seems to have. Other, we work within the law with affinity, and we realize that energy is waiting to be released. What is the magic that will release that energy? What gets people working for the cause, giving their energy, giving their money, giving their vital etheric support, working out in concrete physical actions? What motivates them? Selfishness will not. Self-interest will not, really, shouldn't. but the sacrificial, selfless purpose of an attractive group working according to a motive which has to do with the greatest good of the greatest number. These things attract money for hierarchical purposes. Through this planet Uranus, Libra is also related to Aries and Aquarius, and not to forget, Leo, really. And it is through Uranus that the great pairs of opposites, Aries-Libra, are brought into touch with each other in a very deep sense. Kind of interesting here about the great bear, Aries-Libra, and another planet, the Sun. Veiling Uranus, perhaps? Uranus is certainly connected with the Great Bear in relation to the bringing into expression of the creative hierarchies. If we went over here to... page 50 of Esoteric Astrology, you would see a tabulation to which I've often referred, and the very first one has to do with dynamic energy. And in it, we see the Great Bear and Aries Libra, the Sun veiling Vulcan, not Uranus here, and the second creative hierarchy. But the great pairs of opposites are involved with the Great Bear, and Aries Libra rather represent them. It's kind of like Aries being the first aspect and Libra being the third aspect. So in a way, one is male, one is female. The third aspect of divinity uniting with the first aspect of divinity. Those are, in a way, spirit-matter, according to how DK has been describing Libra in its relationship to the tangible. They are brought into... Uranus is a relating agent, really, just the way Mercury is. Mercury shuttles back and forth between the pairs of opposites. Perhaps Uranus electrically binds them. Aries Libra, symbolizing spirit matter, I think. Through its activity, Uranus, that seventh ray relating agent, an intense interplay takes place, making for the attainment of equilibrium in Libra, of that which had its beginning in Aries. Well, you know, again, if we want to turn to page 329 or so here, we see how Aries begins. Aries, the light of... No, that's the... have to go a little farther. Yes. Hope this is it. Yes. Not 329, but 337. Aries Libra. Unstable embryonic beginnings, Aries, leading to the balancing of the lower psychic nature, Libra, and its expression through form. Embryonic desire for expression consummates in the passion of satisfaction. Lower love controls, and we're told here a little above about Libra that it is unbalanced fiery passion and human love, and here the same thing is stated in a different way. Aries goes to Libra, and Libra being one of the signs of consummation or the bringing together of two in a summit, in a summation. But on the other wheel, reverse wheel, Libra to Aries, the achieved equilibrium at a point of rest provides the mental impetus for soul control. One sees the need of it. One evaluates. One weighs up the spiritual values. Passion is transmuted into love, and the initial desire of Aries becomes the full expression of love wisdom. In Libra, see how love wisdom is related to Libra. Desire to manifest becomes, that's in Libra, the aspiration to be. We have these this interplay going back and forth. It's a complex interweaving, but what is said here has a little bit to do with what is said here. So, 337 and beyond to 247 in the same book. So, through this planet, Uranus, Libra is related to Aries and to Aquarius, and also to Leo. And it's through Uranus that the great pairs of opposites, Aries-Libra, sort of the crown, Aries, and the base, Libra, interestingly enough, are brought into touch with each other. In a way, the Sun and Saturn are opposites, the Sun exalted in Aries, Saturn as the exalted and hierarchical ruler of Libra at the base of the spine. And there's another sense in which the Sun and Uranus are involved with the crown and the base, although Uranus is also involved with the crown, interestingly enough. And it has been said that the Sun, the literal Sun, functions as a kind of base of the spine center. So intricate are the interrelations. Through its activity, an intense interplay takes place, making the attainment of equilibrium. Attainment of equilibrium in Libra of that which had its beginning in Aries. So this rushing forth, the Aries always upsetting the equilibrium, and eventually some balancing of the thrusting soul and the consequent personality is achieved in Libra. Even the balance of spirit and matter, but certainly the balance of soul and personality. So Aries, Libra, and Aquarius constitute therefore another triangle of power, which must later be considered. The consciousness of the one in Aries, the consciousness of the two in Libra, the consciousness of the many as one in Aquarius. Unity and diversity. Perhaps there's no more monolithic sign than Aries. It's about pure being. And it really signifies the number one, where Libra, the sign opposite, certainly signifies the number two. Aquarius, interestingly, contains a three. It is the third sign backwards, counting from Aries. It conveys the third ray. But there's great diversity in Aquarius, but a unifying power. So the one and the many. The one, the two, and the one, and the many are here related. Aries, Libra, and Aquarius constitute, therefore, another triangle of power which must later be considered. These triangles will, as I have earlier hinted, dominate the new astrology. I guess we have to see with what kind of triangle we have been working. Perhaps from our astrological chart, a significant triangle can be isolated. And with the successful expression of that triangle, we may find ourselves working. But how to isolate what is most significant? Of course, there is naturally a triangle between your ascendant, sun, and moon. And the higher triangle between the sun, the ascendant, and the sign opposite the sun. But whether they will be one of the triangles DK emphasized or not, probably the probability is against it. There are so many. Anyway, they will dominate the new astrology as we try to fit into the triangularization which sort of administers the divine plan. They will dominate the new astrology in a most interesting manner, not yet to be revealed, I assume, and condition the charts of those whose horoscopes are being considered, and I suspect, in this case, mostly advanced people and aspirants and disciples, I suspect. And initiates, of course. Libra is related, therefore, to five signs of the zodiac. See, we're building up the relations through the planetary rulers. And it seems that the signs themselves are brought in through the planetary rulers, but of course there are other relations through constellational rays. For instance, Libra is definitely related to Cancer and to Capricorn through the expression of the third ray. And Libra, let's see, is there anything else? No, that's the one. So that's through the constellational rays, and they're also through the planets, the rays coming through the planets. So here we have a story being told with the relations of Venus, Uranus, and maybe Saturn too, I suppose. Capricorn is involved. Libra then is related to Aries through Uranus, giving us beginning. And Aries, the will to create, creation, and evolution, the will to evolve on the third ray. So this is beginnings and progressive beginnings, creatively pursued. Libra is related to Taurus through Venus. We have desire. Desire is the great incentive. If we have desire, we are prodded forward. It spurs us towards our objective, and progress is made. The rush, the onward rush of the bull of God, not always running into a wall, but sometimes making really real progress and having a momentum, which is difficult to stop. Libra is related to Gemini. It is an air sign, but perhaps it's simply through Venus. Duality is found here. The condition of things, which is subject to duality, and the interplay between the pairs of opposites, whether they are horizontal or vertical. Gemini, duality, condition, conditioning, and interplay. Five signs. Libra is not included here, of course. It's the sign that's related. Libra is related to Capricorn through Venus and, I suppose, through Saturn. And the dualities are synthesized in initiation and achievement, which represents the coming together of the dualities into a summation on the summit, on the mountain of initiation, is achieved. Another air sign is here, of course, so Libra is related to the air sign, but through Uranus, Libra is related to Aquarius. Leo is not mentioned, of course. This is a veiled ruler, but Libra and Leo have some very significant relations in terms of the reversal of the wheel, we're told. Sun and Leo, Libra rising, or maybe Sun and Libra, Leo rising, but that's another story. Related to Aquarius, which, what, has to do with the objective of the whole story, which is some sort of universalization, some kind of gathering of all variety into a unity, includes all things, and once this is realized, the goal, or the objective of attainment in Capricorn, is, of course, to serve and to dispense all accumulations on behalf of those who need to be nourished by the waters of life and any type of accumulation. So these are five signs of relation. They kind of show a progression in the realm of where desire leads, to the reconciliation of dualities and to their synthesis, which is an empowerment which includes many and offers service to them. So from the initial beginning, we come to a very full and generous service, a pouring forth of all that has been ingathered. All that has been ingathered is now released, and not just for the one, but for the group, and eventually for the whole, for the all, from Aries to Aquarius. And Libra here is not mentioned, but of course it provides the means by which duality is reconciled, and a preliminary unification occurs on the way to initiatory synthesis and to full universalization inclusion, with the great spiritual generosity that results from that type of identification leads to service. So this relation is established by three rulers, Venus, Uranus, and Saturn, respectively the orthodox, the esoteric, and hierarchical rulers, as well as the, I wonder if we should sometimes include the exalted ruler, or just the planet in exaltation. So into this fivefold combination would be included as well Leo, and Scorpio. Leo with the veiled hierarchical ruler being Uranus, and Scorpio being the sign in which Uranus is exalted. Maybe Pisces. Well, this is a different track, but Pisces could be included as well because Venus is therein exalted. What would be the implications? Obviously, all of these 12 work together all the time, and they work together in smaller groups, in slightly larger groups, in various kinds of groups. It's probably the most fascinating interplay of how 12 work in different combinations of 2 and of 3 and of 4 and of 5 and so forth, until finally all 12 working together. So this is the relation, whatever the relation is said to mean here by DK, that is established by three rulers, Venus, Uranus, and Saturn. These five, with Libra at the point of balance, although you can't really find a middlemost point in a five, can you, create one of the six-pointed stars of evolution, one of them. One of the six-pointed stars of evolution, with presumably Libra being paired with Capricorn and Aquarius, with Aries, Taurus, and Gemini being a natural trio, and probably Leo, Capricorn, Aquarius, in all of which Saturn is prominent, interestingly, even in Aquarius, being the second trio. So one of the six-pointed stars of evolution, and six is here a number of synthesis. It brings together two opposite triangles into an integrative relationship. We're sometimes told of how the sextile, which would be created by the six-pointed star, grand sextile, is an integrative aspect, a harmonizing and integrative aspect. So it creates one of the six-pointed stars of evolution, doesn't tell us what it will do, but I've made a little stab at that, and also bring into relation with them three planets which are peculiarly concerned with the expression of the Christ consciousness in the world. Why should that be? Venus, we can understand. The Christ is a great representative of Venus in a way, and Venus stimulates the solar angels which embody the Christ aspect. And the soul of our planet is nourished by Venus. Saturn, of course, fulfills the law and brings the third aspect of divinity through right fulfillment of the law towards the second. The law of karma has in mind the expression, the balanced and harmonized expression of love, no matter how severe that law may express itself. What about Uranus? How does Uranus bring forth the expression of the Christ consciousness? Well, it brings forth the expression of archetypal relations, and it transforms lower conditions into the pattern which is in heaven, which the Christ is attempting to bring forward. It's somewhat related to the Father aspect in a way, and Venus to the Son aspect, and Saturn to the Holy Spirit aspect, uniting these three. The Father in heaven, and the soul on its own plane, and the world of matter form. And the Christ must represent, through matter, the will of the Father. Well, that's some ideas. Maybe the Tibetan discusses it. These three planets are, through the rays of which they are the medium, all to be found upon the first major line of force. How interesting in relation to this apparently soft and harmonizing and attractive sign, Libra. Well, only when interpreted only in terms of Venus. But in their soul nature, Venus, Uranus, and Saturn are found respectively upon the fifth, the seventh, and the third rays, the line of will and power and of purpose, and a vision goal, to which the vision goal, let's see, the vision of destiny. And the first aspect is that which leads ever onward, progressively, in a straight line, towards the consummation of destiny. So he's connecting Libra with the first line of force. And we find law, sex, and money, I guess, in a way related to this hard line, although Venus, as the planet of affinity, is bringing forward its second ray aspect more in the sex position. As for Uranus in relation to money, the third aspect will do, the third ray will do, and the seventh ray will certainly do. As for Saturn in relation to law, it has a first ray component, and its third ray is allied. I sometimes think of the work of the Supreme Court that uses the third ray, the reasoning power, the large historical point of view, to determine what is lawful under the first ray and what is not, the combination of the third and the first ray. But let's see what he says, because he seems to, he does accord in this manner. Uranus, seventh ray of ceremonial magic in its soul expression, God the Father, you know, the heavenly one, Uranus, who is even the father of Saturn, he who relates, as the seventh ray relates all things. Seventh ray is the ray that brings things into relation, but the second ray does too in a different way. The source of duality. There is kind of a cleavage in the symbol of Uranus. The one as the source of the two, and he who perceives the end from the beginning. Why? Because Uranus rules the archetype, and the archetype will be the end. It is at the beginning, and it affects all of the configurations in the mosaic particulate world to configure themselves according to the archetype, which will be the end, which was at the beginning. Spiritual consciousness, often even divine consciousness. What does it allow here? Intuition to inspiration. We recall when we were dealing with intuition and inspiration, if we want to call illumination intuition, or intuition resulting in illumination, we had a relationship between Scorpio and Sagittarius. Sagittarius giving inspiration, and Scorpio giving illumination. But from another point of view, we can look at the relationship between the monadic plane and the Buddhic plane as planes of intuition, and the logoic plane, ruled by Uranus in a sense, as the plane of inspiration. It's the very highest on the cosmic physical plane, and the highest and lowest must relate and meet. In a way, Saturn rules the dense systemic physical plane, even as it rules the entire cosmic physical plane. But we have Uranus above, Saturn below, when we consider the systemic planes. How is Uranus the source of duality? It does split things in a way, kind of reveals the split between spirit and matter. Sometimes when lightning cleaves the night sky, it gives us a sense of what is heavenly and what is earthly. But I will continue to ponder on that. Anyway, from intuition to inspiration, Uranus is also that bolt out of the blue, which we sometimes call intuition, a sudden thought, an idea. But the idea is inspiring. It is energizing. It carries the breath of God, carries the first aspect. So Uranus, even though it... sometimes Saturn is God the Father, of course, or the Father aspect anyway, but God the Father, not just the Father aspect, is Uranus, yes. But strangely connected in the secondary line of force, which gives us Sirius, Uranus, how does it go? Sirius, Pisces, Uranus, and then the heart center and solar plexus center. Interesting. So these three rays are peculiarly the expressions of the Christ consciousness in the world. The Christ came to express the Father. He who has seen me hath seen the Father. No man cometh to the Father except through me. And Uranus can be combined in that interesting triangle of Saturn, Uranus, Mercury, Uranus will represent the second aspect in that particular triangle, interestingly. Then we come to Venus. It suggests or expresses through its soul nature, the fifth ray of mind. It represents God the Son, and certainly it is the middle principle for man. It is represented by the solar angel, which is the middle, or informs the middle principle. Venus has a very strong second ray and sixth ray, thus associated with the God the Son. It's the Son of mind. It's the Son and mind combined. It's the second or Son aspect and the mind aspect combined. Interesting. He who includes, that's certainly Christ-like, isn't it? He who embraces, the second aspect does embrace, even though Venus is representing in its soul nature the fifth ray of mind. It is egoic consciousness. And it passes from the fifth ray of mind, which is certainly the intellect, to intuition. Venus is buddhically developed at this time and is connected with the sixth subplane from below above of the cosmic astral plane. So that's sort of the buddhic principle, the sixth principle on the cosmic astral plane. It's associated with both 2 and 6, interestingly, at this time, and its development is buddhic in its nature at this time, whereas the Earth is not quite there. He who includes, you usually think of Jupiter when you think of that, but it is the loving, harmonizing, unifying, embracing, thou art that, inclusive, egoic consciousness, and the ego is found connected with the numbers 2 and the numbers 5. It is the second second periodical vehicle, the second of 3, but it's on the fifth plane of mind, and it moves from intellect to intuition. We are interested in Manas Buddhi. This is, we are interested here in, I suppose, Buddhi Atma, when we talk about intuition to inspiration. But when I think of the real source of inspiration, I do think of the logoic plane particularly, at least on our cosmic physical plane, that sea of fire. Then we come to Saturn. It especially expresses the third ray of intelligence. Maybe, certainly in its monadic nature, DK actually gives that around 420 or 421 of Esoteric Psychology 1. He tells us that the esoteric ray, watch out there, when he says esoteric, he means monadic, the esoteric ray of Saturn is the third. And very possibly the soul ray may be that, or perhaps the first. There's a strong first ray with Saturn. So this is the third ray of intelligence, God the Holy Spirit, He who knows. Saturn represents the atmic plane, which is the plane of knowledge when looking at the cosmic physical plane. Plane of will is logoic, plane of love is monadic, plane of knowledge is Saturnian, the third, the atmic. It is mind, the one of the three synthesizing planets which most represents mind, and it has a peculiar connection with humanity. And so does Venus, for that matter. Human consciousness, maybe that's the Saturn-Leo connection. Leo, the most human of the signs, Saturn representing human consciousness. Human consciousness is limited to the lower 18 subplanes where Saturn rules particularly. Its number, in a way, being a 9, it's a 3 and a 9. It completes the group of planets which lies at the outer boundary of the conventional solar system. Its number is a 9 and a 3, and you look at the 18 lower subplanes, that sums to 9 as well. And these are the concrete subplanes, and Saturn has everything to do with concretion in the dense physical body of our planetary logos, not the dense physical body of our solar logos, which is 21 subplanes and includes the Sun of Mind and Venus. Uranus, in a way, is all of the cosmic ethers as they ascend even unto the logoic plane. There are 4 of them. Buddhi, Atma, Monad, and Logoic. Now, all of these are said to be particularly related to the expression of the Christ consciousness in the world. Maybe that word expression, because the will to express comes in on the seventh ray. So it's not maybe the Christ consciousness per se, but the expression of it through the lower worlds. It says, in the world. Now, what is the world? Is the world the lower 18 subplanes? Perhaps. It is for this basic reason, founded on the above triple relationship, that Libra is the point of balance in the zodiac, even though it's not technically, as it would be in a zodiac of 11, exactly at the midway point. Still, it's a point of balance, suggesting that there are six before it itself, and then five. In most of the other constellations, at some stage or other, there comes a point of crisis, wherein the effect of the energy pouring through the sign via the ruling planets to man is at its highest point of effectiveness. Now, Libra is later associated with crisis. We have to just see whether he means to make that case at this point. This, in time, precipitates the crisis which is required to release the man from the planetary influences which condition his personality and bring him more definitely and consciously under the influence of the sign of the zodiac. This is interesting, a transition from planet to sign, even though the planet may be quite high. So, a transition from planet to sign. At first, I suppose, we will be more ruled by the planets which are associated with our important signs, and later, as we move towards soul and spirit, more influenced by the sign itself. After all, the Lord of the constellation is a greater being than the Lord of the Lord of a planet. Now, he will, before long, relate Libra as a sign of crisis. But here he doesn't, at least not as crisis is described in this section. There is a highest point of effectiveness. A highest point of effectiveness. The energy through the sign is at its highest point of effectiveness, and this precipitates a crisis, a turning point, something that must be done, something that must emerge, which is related to the release of the man from planetary influences, even from the hierarchical ruler, we might ask. Well, at least which condition his personality. So I suppose the Orthodox ruler particularly conditions his personality and brings him more definitely at this point under the influence of the sign of the zodiac. We have to keenly discriminate here what it would be, you know, to move from Mars to Aries per se. And certainly the sense of a larger purpose and plan and pattern would be given in Aries when compared to Mars. What about when moving from Venus to Taurus, let us say? Well, Venus has all of the love of beauty and magnetism and a certain measure of the light, but Taurus has a still greater light and understands somewhat what is the light of the spirit. So you can understand a movement there from Venus to Taurus, and we could go through all of the Orthodox rulers of the signs and see what might be the transition after a crisis, which would move one from planetary conditioning to come more fully under the influence of the sign itself. Now, will this happen in the case of the esoteric ruler and the hierarchical ruler? I'm not sure, because the word personality is mentioned here, and the esoteric ruler and the hierarchical ruler are not so concerned with personality conditions, though they may be concerned with the expression of the soul through the personality. But anyway, at this point, he says in Libra, there is no such point of crisis any more than in Aries, even though I gave kind of an Aries example. Interesting. that these signs of commencement of the two hemicycles are not signs of crisis in this sense, where there is an intense point of effectiveness and a crisis which precipitates a movement towards a greater reception by the sign than by the planet. There is only an interlude of balance. I guess these are the equinoxes over which both Aries and Libra rule. These are interludes of balance, the two equinoxes, as a prelude to more effective and sensitive progress upon the path. You kind of wonder whether Aries also looks ahead before it plunges. Certainly Libra does, and evaluates. There is sometimes for Aries people a kind of hesitation before entering. And perhaps this is what's meant by this interlude of balance. Let us see here for a moment where we are. Well, we are making progress. We're almost there, wherever there is. It is the same in Aries. The same, okay. I mean, after the entire progress around the zodiac, we reach Aries, and we have to decide how shall we plunge. Well, let form again be sought, but that's one way of looking at it, but not when we're going counterclockwise. Then I come forth, and from the plane of mind I rule. So presumably there is an evaluation of where to put that energy, although Aries has the tradition of the one that plunges in, perhaps without hesitation. Now, what I am saying is, for the Aries people I know, there is often hesitation, or what Dane Rudyard called fatigue before the act, not after the act. Interesting. Almost like a feeling of being overwhelmed by that which is to be undertaken. But anyway, not the crisis that releases into the meaning of the sign so much. This is surprising to me a little bit. So this point of maximal planetary effectiveness precipitates a crisis which is required to release the man from planetary influences. Which condition is personality? Maybe hierarchical rulers don't. And bring him more definitely, he's already been somewhat under that influence, and more consciously under the influence of the sign of the zodiac. And I suppose the sign of the zodiac at a certain level of expression. Maybe there's always a transition from the planet to this greater constellational lord, or the energy of that constellational lord. So anyway, even in Aries, there is only the interlude of balance as a prelude to more effective and sensitive progress. Every time you begin a hemicycle, you have a new opportunity. Aries, the beginning of the first hemicycle, and Libra, the beginning of the second, depending on how we look at the numbering of the zodiac. It is the same in Aries, as it is esoterically said, before creation, silence, and the stillness of a focused point. I suppose the mature Aries enters into this pre-creative silence, envisioning the whole thing that lies before, and the stillness of a focused point. This reminds me a little bit of that point of light to be found here again in the Cancer chapter, interestingly, right here in Aries, the light of life itself. This is a dim point of light found at the center of the cycle of manifestation, faint and flickering. It is the searchlight of the Logos, or any Logos who's about to create, searching what's to be created, I suppose, seeking that which can be used, before plunging in, an interlude of evaluation. So this is new to me in a way, although experience seems to confirm it. Seeking that which is to be used for divine expression. These are interludes. Before creation, silence, and the stillness of a focus point. This applies both to Aries and Libra, the one perhaps creating more individually, the other more in the group sense. But he says the one in a cosmic and creative sense, and that's Aries, and the other in an individual and progressive evolutionary sense, it's one of the human signs, and that is Libra. What a rich chapter this is. Of course, you see, the Tibetan has so many relations to reveal to us that his method is anything but linear. A, B, L. Anything but linear. And as a result, we are enriched in each chapter with many connections to other points of view. He doesn't want us to consider anything outside of relation. He is then giving us what we call a lesson in pure reason. In pure reason, we understand the relation of all things to anything and of anything to all things. And we do not look at things purely in fifth-ray isolation, as is at least done when we are using the fifth ray at the beginning. There's a whole network of relationships under the second and third ray, and I think the Tibetan is strongly influenced by both rays, but time will tell. He's going to say the following planets and their rays govern the cardinal cross, of which Libra is one of the points. Well, I think I better reserve that until the next program, whenever that occurs, because this is a complicated and intricate interrelationship here, and it's better not to begin something and then sort of rush through it. Yes, why later will Libra be considered a sign of crisis? Perhaps with Leo and, I don't know, maybe with Capricorn? We have to look for that. Maybe I can just look very quickly. And Libra and crisis, 13. Woo! Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Libra, yeah, here it is. Look, there is a crisis. Signs of crisis. And the other nine are not included. Leo, the crisis of individualism or individualization. Libra, the crisis of balance. It's not quite the kind of crisis he was describing earlier, where all the planetary energies come together at maximum effectiveness and force a kind of reorientation towards the meaning of the astrological sign itself away from the planet. And also Capricorn, the crisis of initiation. So, yes, Libra, a sign of crisis, and yet not a sign of crisis. We have to understand this kind of interlude of evaluation, which is not forced, shall we say. Interestingly, Venus is said to rule the first decanate of Aries. Jupiter, yes, and Venus as well. So Venus is involved in both cases. But he's going to give a different decanate ruler, I think Jupiter as well. We'll have to look at why it is that Jupiter rules the first decanate of Libra, when you would expect Venus to, and why Jupiter rules the first decanate of Aries, when you would expect Mars to, and why Venus is found as a kind of decanate ruler, even in that first Aries decanate. Well, we'll get on to these things. So, but in Libra, there is no such point of crisis. Maybe that particular type of crisis, where there is the crisis of the balance, causing, I suppose, some sort of action to break the balance. Anyway, we are at the end of Esoteric Astrology 81E, page something. Hope I didn't skip it. Seems I did. So let's look back here at a foregoing page. Oh, goodness. I'm having my difficulty here. Page 247, is that it? Okay, let's call it 247. I don't see a 248. Yep. Aha, 248. There it is. We're on page 248. And we will begin either with EAA 248, begin either with EAA 81F or with 82A. EAA beginning. Let's call it for the moment 81F, but I'm not sure whether that's going to be possible. All right, friends. We are at that point, and these long days of thinking of nothing but astrology, but in the last analysis, step by step, something is accomplished, even though the instrument trying to convey this gets a little weary. So, okay, we will move on when we can move on. And for the moment, ciao. Ciao.